Support for this podcast comes from Planned Parenthood. It's hard to imagine a world where we leave future generations with fewer rights and freedoms. Since the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills aimed at blocking people from getting the essential sexual and reproductive care they need, including abortion. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves access to care. And with supporters like you, they can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future to learn more and support their cause.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias. My guest today, Adam Ozimek, is a chief economist at Upwork. And a leading authority, I would say, on remote work, which is integral to Upwork's business model. And I think like a lot of people are thinking about remote work now because of the pandemic, thinking about the future. But part of what's great about Adam's research on this is that it's actually something you've been thinking about since before the pandemic, which I think provides some better kind of insights into this. So, Adam, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So something that I think is interesting that a lot of people sort of get wrong about this is not understanding like what the baseline was for remote work and what the trends were before COVID kind of hit. And I remember I learned this from you. I was actually surprised like fewer people worked remotely than I had realized. So, you know, because it helps you understand like how big a change this is. So like, what do we know if you flashed back to January 2020, like what was going on with remote?
So it's a surprisingly tough thing to get a great measure on because, you know, it depends exactly what you're asking. If you ask someone, are you working from home? That's a different thing from working remotely because home is only one of the places that you can work remotely. But what makes working from home nice is it's pretty like clear what it means. And then once you sort of get more accurate and start talking about working remotely, then you open the door to all sorts of things to like, well, is that remote? Like I'm a salesman on the road. Like, is that remote? I'm like a telephone line repairman. Is that remote? Like, I don't have an office. There's no office I go to. Or like more like those are easy ones where you're like, okay, well, that shouldn't count as remote. But something that's sort of more in the middle is like, I'm a graphic designer. I have my own private office like downtown where I see clients and they come to my office. And that maybe I have like two employees. But like, you know, that's like really close from the perspective of like your relationship with most of the businesses that you work for. It is effectively remote. So the best we can do is sort of ranges, I think. And the way I think of it is pre-COVID, we probably had between 5 to 10% being fully remote. And that when you get towards 10%, you're going to start to be including people who were like, is that remote? Does that really count as remote? And it sort of like gets into the gray area. So that's sort of what I think is the baseline. If you look at work from home, it's probably more like 3.5%. And the BLS says 2.5%, but their measure is only for wage and salary workers from the American Time Use Survey. And so that doesn't include self-employed people. That doesn't include freelancers, stuff like that. So it's probably more like 3.5% strictly work from home, 5 to 10% as you get into wider definitions of remote. And then probably like another 10% on top of that, maybe even 15 who are remote sometimes. But remote sometimes is even grayer, right? It's even like fuzzier because like if you come home from work and do some work at home, if you ask that person, do they do work from home? They might say yes, but they might just be answering emails on their phone. So the baseline is really tough to measure, but I think of it as 5 to 10.
I mean, that's an important point, right? Because we had this kind of revolution a while ago where it became totally normal that if you have a kind of white collar work with a computer job, that at least like sometimes you'll be doing work at your house. Like nobody would have found that shocking if it was like after the kid goes to bed, I do some work, right? Like that's very normal. Whereas if you had like, I don't know, like giant typewriters that had to be lugged back and forth, like you might not actually sort of do that, right? So you have a trend that is evolving along sort of different dimensions in different ways, but to have an economic impact, right? Like that doesn't count, right? Like if we're interested in like big picture economic changes, the issue isn't like, can you sometimes get a work task done from your house? It's like, are you commuting on a daily basis? Does your employer need to provision you with office space?
Right. It's a change in the way we work and it has an economic impact, but it's not a total disruption. Like, it's not a revolution in the way we work, the way that, you know, working from home, working remotely now post-COVID seems like it will be.
And the trend was up pre-COVID, right?
Yeah, the best trend data we have is from the ACS, where they ask what your primary work location is. And that was, from home was one of the options. And so from the ACS and the decennial census before that, you can see a pretty steady trend from, 1980 straight up through 2019 of increasing.
ACS is the American Community Survey for listeners at home who are not census kind of nerds. So this was a thing, right? So like before COVID, you would say, okay, like computers are getting better, broadband's getting faster, people use different chat apps. Like it's just like the information technology keeps improving. So we have a kind of slow, steady increase in the amount of people working from home or being sort of all remote. And that's the kind of background. And then how does the pandemic change that? Like obviously we know like a lot of people were sent home from the office, but like how do you think about that as impacting the trend?
So I think we can take the changes that happen and sort of bucket them into economic concepts. The first and most obvious one is learning by doing. And what we've seen is that they're finding that remote work works better than they thought. And so there was sort of this pessimism about it. So we did a survey in April that asked this question very specifically of 1,000 hiring managers. How is remote work going? Is it better? A little better, a lot better, worse, a lot worse. And the vast, vast majority, like 9 out of 10, it was going better than they thought. So for whatever reason, there was just this pessimism about how well it was going to work. And people are learning that it worked better than they thought. So I think part of the problem there also has to do with sort of an ex-inefficiency driven by variation and comfort with remote work by age. And this, this goes back to some of the work I did in the past on age and productivity. And I think that older workers block technological change at the firm level because they don't want to learn new things because they've got a lower amount of time in their careers to sort of recoup the investment losses. And that's just sort of a thing that happens. And so older managers do not like remote work as much. I showed this in some data before COVID. Younger people like remote work, both as younger business owners like remote work more, younger managers like remote work more, and younger workers like remote work more. So you have this sort of like age bias, and the people who tend to be in charge tend to not like it as much. So you get into a little bit of personal preferences there.
Right. So, I mean, this is like classic, like grandpa doesn't know how to program the VCR, like when we were kids, right? But it comes into the workplace, right? So higher status people in a workplace are usually older. And, older people are less interested in like new stuff, right? So it can slow kind of adaptation. And then I also think, right, like the actual age of the business has to be a factor too, right? Like people in general, like don't like to change things if there's no particularly compelling reason to. Whereas if you start something new, you might think it's like you have to decide, right? Like,
right.
How is this going to work? which is different from like we just kind of stick with the default. How much better is it sort of going than people thought it would?
So there's a couple of ways to look at that. Pre-COVID, you have a few experimental studies on remote work. And, you know, these are really rigorously done. And, you know, basically people were offered, you know, randomized access to either work from home and also work from anywhere. You have one study from Nick Bloom and a team of co-authors using like a call center workers at a travel agency. And then you have the U.S. Patent Trademark Office also offered a work from anywhere option, you know, sort of randomized to their patent officers or patent examiners. And in both cases, we find, you know, productivity goes up. And that's really sort of credibly identified, you would say. Like, you really believe that it happened. You also have Emma Harrington, who's an economist at Harvard, has a really nice paper that she was starting a remote work experiment with a large national retailer for their customer service reps before COVID. And then COVID sort of like affected the study in a nice randomized way. And she also found productivity goes up. So basically anywhere that it's been done, like studied rigorously, productivity goes up. Now, obviously, two out of three of those are pre-COVID studies. And you also have a lot of sort of narrowness in the occupations that it's been tried on. So you have to worry about external validity. But when we asked hiring managers, we found early on it was, I think it was 32% to 20%, or 32 to 22 was the ratio of higher productivity versus lower productivity. And that might sound like, oh, well, you know, that's kind of like narrow. That's only like, oh, is that like a 10% increase in productivity then? If it goes up for 33%, it goes down for 22%. But the important thing to realize is that these short-term effects are, A, when companies were thrown into the water, feet first, into remote work. This was like early on in the pandemic. And even then, even when they were just learning how to work, more thought productivity went up than less. The other thing is you have selection effects over time that are going to make sure that like firms who, these managers who are like, this stinks, our productivity went down, this doesn't work for us, they're not going to do it, right? And so like that 22% who went down, they're going to go away. They're going to go back to the way they used to work. And then you'll be left with the 32% who went up. So that's like a pretty significant potential effect on productivity in the aggregate there, I think.
Wait. So that's when we start talking post-COVID, right? Because I find that a lot of the discussion around this topic as like a future thing gets like excessively polarized, right? Where somebody will say like, well, I don't like working remotely, right? Or like at my company, this hasn't worked well. And we have a lot of people in America and a lot of different companies. And the point of that low baseline is that, you know, if 40% of office work went remote, that would be a huge increase and totally compatible with like some companies think it's bad or like some people don't enjoy it. I've also realized I've been thinking about this, and I realized that journalists who we control the media have an unusual relationship to this, because the normal paradigm in journalism for a long time is that you work where the subjects of your stories are, right? And some of the work has always been remote. Like, it's totally normal. Like, a newspaper has a bureau on a different continent, right? And the point is that, well, they have to be in the London bureau because they're covering the United Kingdom. And that's just not, that's like not what the issue is in a sort of typical kind of work environment, right? It's a little bit of, and as you say, it's like different industries, different companies might kind of vary, but that there's a large number that are seeing a big advantage here.
Yeah, I think there's that. There's sort of like being affected by people's views on this are affected too much by their own personal views of how remote work works for them and their occupations and their companies. And sure, you could say the same of me as someone who is a remote worker at a remote working company who was remote working before I remote worked here, and really likes it. But you know, I'm focused pretty steadily on the data and not my own personal experiences here. But I think the other thing that colors perceptions of this is sort of extroverts versus introverts, and sort of projection and an assumption that because you prefer the current balance of the way work goes, then that must be optimal. Versus, like, I think introverts who have spent, you know, decades working in an office that was not the right fit for them, they just sort of had to accept that just because this is not my preferred way of working, like, that doesn't mean that it's not optimal. And now it's sort of in some situations, I think it's switched and you know, people are sort of extroverts at a company where remote work will work and they just don't like it, but they can't sort of process that the difference between I don't like it and this isn't going to work for the company overall.
Well, this is where I also think there's a, one question is like, what does it mean for a workplace arrangement to work well? Right. You know, people get jobs. They do jobs for money, but they also care about the sort of quality of their experience and their life. Right. And I think it's typical. Right. If you like really enjoy like BSing around with your coworkers over lunch and you're doing that in the workplace with people who, you know, because you work together, you will probably come up with some reason why that's super duper important to your work. And it even might, like it might be, right? But your perception that it's important or useful is just not necessarily accurate. You know, there's this long time in sort of blue collar occupations, right? There's this kind of like Fordist measurement of what are people actually doing. And it's not necessarily the same as like what they happen to like want to do. I found, you know, long pre-COVID, when I went into a remote working situation, that I was way faster at just like getting my work done, precisely because I didn't like it. So like I would just do my work and then go do something else. Whereas before at my previous company, I really liked my coworkers. Like I would stay on the job for super long hours because like we were having fun, and I think politics is really interesting. And I like them a lot. And some of those people are still my best friends today. But like that was something to do with work. Then when like I shifted to this grim job where I did not like the commute, but also my manager didn't make me come into the office, like I could just get things done way faster.
Yeah, I think that's probably another part of it too, that sort of how this discussion gets colored by who's talking about it in the media, is that like media people are all, you know, they share interests and they're in the office like having fun together, and it's my perception anyway, it sounds like it's true. And they're like you know, their job is, it's like a fun interactive knowledge work, and they like all share similar passions and interests, and you know, probably are way more interested in the same topics with each other, it, like as hobbies. Like you don't go into like journalism or a particular kind of media unless you also like really like what you're doing as like a hobby. And so you share that with people in your work. And so it's hard to imagine. Like I've had people, when I've said on like Twitter, like with remote work, you can spend more time with your friends. And people are like, well, what if all my friends are at my office? And it's like, you got to know that that's not normal. Like that's not the way it is for most people. And like, if you work for a paper company, you're probably not like all tied together by this love of paper. And like,
I was going to say that, yeah, I think media people should think more about Dunder Mifflin, yeah, right? And how it's portrayed there that like they don't necessarily have a lot in common. They don't necessarily have a shared passion for the paper industry. They just happen to live in Scranton. And so they're trying to get jobs. And I don't know, there's only so many employers in Scranton, so they're working at Dunder Mifflin. But like, if they could work remotely, they could live in Scranton and they could work for all kinds of companies.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the more of the world is like that than is like people who like had a passion for sports journalism and wound up at a business full of a bunch of other sports journalists.
Yeah, no, I mean, exactly. I think that's really important. Let's take a break here, and then I want to talk about some of the consequences.
Support for this podcast comes from Planned Parenthood. Your body is your own. That's why Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Today, lawmakers who oppose abortion are challenging Planned Parenthood. Affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. Planned Parenthood believes that health care is a basic human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies. They also work tirelessly to oppose the onslaught of new policies aimed at interfering with personal decisions best left to patients and their doctors. They won't give up, and they won't back down. You can join Planned Parenthood in the fight to help make sure that the next generation can decide their own futures. The organization needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, they can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future to learn more and support their cause.
Support for The Weeds comes from Burrow. Okay, are you ready for the understatement of the century? Buying furniture can be frustrating. You end up visiting a bunch of stores searching aimlessly for the right pieces to match your home, then spend hours trying to get those pieces together, or together again if you got it wrong the first time. And that's even if you were able to get it through the door. Burrow is a furniture company that wants to make the whole thing easier. Burrow's new Dune line features a contemporary yet timeless look inspired by the craftsmanship of classic mid-century construction. If you're looking to bring a sense of luxury, comfort, and durability to your outdoor spaces, you might want to consider Burrow. Like all of Burrow's pieces, they offer easy assembly and disassembly so you can move or store them away as needed. Not only that, they ship straight to your door for free. Listeners of The Weeds can get 15% off their first order at burrow.com/weeds. That's Burrow, BURROW.com/weeds for 15% off. Burrow.com/weeds.
So if we sort of accept the view that, you know, this will be at least a somewhat sticky transition with more remote work happening next year, the year after, and onward into the future, like, what are the consequences of that, separate from sort of how it impacts individual people's lifestyles? Like, what does it mean for the big picture?
Yeah, I think that one of the big implications is about places and how it's going to affect places. And I think that it's going to affect migration patterns and where people decide to live. You know, sort of the status quo, if you were to do a quick summary of the last 30 years of economic geography, it's been that, you know, high-skilled work, high-skilled jobs, productivity growth, and innovation have been clustered in a handful of places. And it's a term I know you think a lot about, Matt, which is the term superstar cities, right? And so there's been that happening, and we talk a lot about that. But what's happening in the rest of the country is you have demographic decline because population is falling. Prime working age population is falling even faster and more widespread. And you have sort of skill-biased migration trends where the people with the most abilities, with the most skills, highest human capital, they tend to leave these other places and go to these superstar cities because that's where there's agglomeration economies. That's where they get to earn the most for their pay. And I think that this has negative repercussions on the places that those people leave. They have falling tax bases, therefore ability to pay for government services. They also are losing their most entrepreneurial people, their most innovative people. And so I see this as something that can help sort of lean against that trend. It's the first technological change. And I'm not saying it's going to reverse that by any means, but like it's something going in the other direction that lets workers gain access to those agglomeration economy jobs without actually leaving the place where they're at and without actually moving to those cities.
And I think, you know, to make it concrete, right? I mean, I remember talking to the chancellor of University of Wisconsin, Madison campus, you know, when she was saying that this is sort of the trend, right? University of Wisconsin's a good school. Smart kids go there. It's well-regarded. They get good degrees. They have the skills to get good jobs. There's some good jobs available in Madison, but not that many. It's just like not that big of a city. It's actually a pretty affluent city, but like unless you happen to want to work for Wisconsin state government or this one technology company that's there, you know, there's not that much going on. Milwaukee has been in this cycle of decline now for decades. And so people go to Chicago or they go, you know, far, far away to the coasts. And it's like, it's a shame. More people from Wisconsin who go to college and get good skills would probably live in Wisconsin if there were other people with good jobs in Wisconsin. But you get just kind of locked into these cycles of decline that are really challenging to break, whereas not moving is like really easy for everybody, right? Even if like Wisconsin's still cold, whatever else. But like if you're already there and you can get work from the house that you already live in and keep hanging out with the friends that you already have, like that's just naturally an appealing option to people. And it changes the whole sort of dynamic in a state like that.
Yeah. And I think that's a really important aspect of it to focus on, because everyone's talking about where's everyone going to go when they leave San Francisco and New York City, and they're talking about this, the out migration, and there I think people are like struggling to believe that anyone's going to Wisconsin. Like, you're not going to leave Brooklyn and go to Wisconsin, but like, I think you need to think about in the long run, a lot of what the way population distribution is shaped by out-migration from these places. And it's a lot more plausible that someone's never going to leave Wisconsin for Brooklyn than go back. And I do think that, you know, we're going to see people go back too. But yeah, the reduction in out-migration, I think, is really important.
And I mean, we've seen a sort of long-term actual decline. There's a misperception that people move more frequently than they used to, when actually it's the reverse, right? There's been less interregional migration, but it's happened selectively by the sort of most skilled people.
Right. And it happens in the context of overall slowing U.S. population growth and an overall decrease in the number of prime age people. And so, like, it's much less problematic when you have high levels of out migration from Wisconsin, when you have like underlying population growth, so that like at the end of the day, if you're a business owner, you don't have to worry that you're going to have 20% less customers a decade from now because the population's shrinking, right? And like, there's all these like negative effects of shrinking population growth. And like, if you have that underlying birth rate or immigration to keep it up, then you can handle out migration more. Because I do think that there is something, you know, there is something special about zero here. There is something where shrinking a little is really bad, in a way that, like, if your population growth rate, your underlying rate is like 2%, and like because of more out migration you go down to like 1.5%, I think that's like not really a big problem for you. But if your population growth rate is zero and you go to -0.5%, I think that is a really big problem for you, especially in the context of aging.
Yeah, well, also, I mean, I think if you wanted to try to formalize that, right, it's like structures have a depreciation schedule. And if you have a population growth rate, it probably needs to be a little bit above zero to, like, make it pay off to maintain, like, the existing capital stock. You're in much better shape than if you get into this sort of collapse dynamic. But let's talk about superstar cities, because people like this. One thing that I think we should be aware of is that when economists say cities, they mean what normal people call, I don't even know what they call them, but it's like it's like cities and their suburbs, right? Because like most Americans live in the suburbs, like the vast majority of the people in Seattle, quote unquote, like live in the suburbs. And it seems to me that when I see the COVID, at least, population trends and rental price trends, what we've seen is a fall in rents in the central cities, but not necessarily in the suburbs, right? So like in New York, like greater New York, the real estate markets in the suburbs have been really hot, which to me at least looks like a pandemic effect more than a remote work effect. Like, living in the city sucks if the restaurants are going to be closed. I want a yard for my kids to play in, which like has always been why most people live in the suburbs, but just kind of going up, right? I mean, whereas what you're talking about would be actually unraveling the like commuting patterns that lead so many people to live in northern New Jersey.
I think that there's not going to be any one effect that affects all sort of cities the same. I think that the simplest thing that's going to happen is the places that are expensive due to agglomeration will decline in population. And maybe that population will rebound and they'll just end up being entirely a price decline because, like, you know, riding up and down the inelastic housing supply curve. Like basically you didn't build new things in the first place. So not a whole lot of new people live there. Mostly prices just went up. And so mostly prices will just go down. Outside of that prediction, which I think has pretty clear implications for, you know, New York City, San Francisco, Seattle. I think that there's a lot of uncertainty and there's a lot of different ways it can go. One place I like to think about, and not just because it's in my backyard, but because I think it's illustrative, is Philadelphia. So you can think of all these different mechanisms by which Philadelphia both loses and gains here, Philadelphia could potentially gain a lot because, you know, some people used to live in Philly and take Amtrak to New York City. That was their commute. It's kind of a bad commute. Like, it's a long train ride, especially when you take the time to get to the station and then to get wherever you're going. I think you're probably talking like 2 hours or something like that. Like, that's a bad commute. But some people did it. And that becomes a lot easier when you're talking about a couple times a month, right? So I think Philadelphia could benefit from people leaving New York and D.C. and going for the lower cost of living in Philadelphia and still having their urban amenities. On the other hand, you know, there's an Amtrak line into Philadelphia from all these lower cost places in Pennsylvania. And I think you can see a lot of people who decide, you know, I can get into my Philadelphia office job at a law firm, you know, once a week, and then I can live out in, you know, in Lancaster where I am. And like, now that that hour and 15, hour and a half commute into Philadelphia is a lot easier. So like, there's a lot of uncertainty when it comes to like second class cities and their suburbs and where exactly who's going to benefit and who's going to lose. I think the clearest prediction though is like, if you are really expensive right now and you're expensive because of access to agglomeration, like, this is going to cost you. And I think that that applies to some city centers and also some suburbs too. Like if you are like a relatively monopolized suburb in terms of access to your city, you might lose out because in the long run now there are, each city effectively has more suburbs.
Because you can go from further.
Exactly. Like, now a 2 hour commute is less of a big deal. So, you know, if you're at that hour commute into the city, you benefit because, well, now people are going to be more willing to live here because like that hour commute into the city isn't as big of a deal. But now also, you know, you have to compete with places that are 2 hours away, which if you think about like a city like New York City is a pretty big geographic area.
Right. I mean, yeah, it's interesting. You know, I remember years ago, Vox Media had a sort of, I don't know what you would call it. It was like a summit in Philadelphia because the people were mostly based in either New York or D.C. So Philadelphia was a convenient place to meet up. And I mean, I remember saying to the CEO, it's like, well, why don't we just have the office here? And, you know, if people need to go to Washington to report, like, it's not like you can't get there from Philadelphia. You wouldn't want to do it every day. And he was like, yeah, that makes sense. You know, and then, you know, obviously we didn't do it. But part of that is that, like, Vox is a very remote friendly company pre-pandemic with lots of people who live nowhere near the office. And that's, I think, like, one of the reasons that the kind of summit happened at all. Right. Which I think is going to be a sort of potentially interesting secondary effect. Right. Which is that if you don't have an office where everybody's gathered all the time, you might then want to like do special things because it could go both ways. You could say like, well, we don't really need to do this conference in person. We can do this stuff online as people have been doing. But you also might say that like, well, since we don't normally all get together like once a year, we should. Right. And to me, that's sort of similar to the Philadelphia question, where like it seems like there will be a change, but it's kind of hard to know what it would be in the aggregate.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the business trips, you know, will business trips go up or down from this, right? Like overall, it's kind of hard to say. And same thing, Philadelphia. Will they benefit or will they lose from this? But I do think that the most confident predictions are, you know, if you can find places where they've got agglomeration built into the housing price premium.
Right.
That's a place that's going to get hit. That's like sort of the more confident thing. And I also think if you see places where you have a low cost of living alongside good amenities, that's another kind of place that's going to win. But outside of those sort of big picture predictions and outside of like the superstar cities, it's harder to predict exactly what will happen. But I think that enough things have changed in terms of what matters and how people are going to decide that it's pretty clear there's going to be big changes.
How can we tell, right? Like I have my sort of like biases in my head that like the price premium in Seattle is like just agglomeration, whereas in New York, it's in part agglomeration and in part like people enjoy New York. And I guess my casual evidence for that would be that like international billionaires like sometimes keep apartments in New York or like movie stars sometimes live in New York, even though it's not where their industry is. Whereas, like, I've never heard of anybody getting a pied-à-terre in Seattle. No hate, but it's just like, it's like really rainy there. There's no sunshine. And like people go there because they're working for Amazon. Whereas like Los Angeles, right? Like there's the beach, like they have really good weather. Like there's a lot going for it, separate from the sort of industry. And is there like a way we can tell where the agglomeration is?
Well, one way to do this is to sort of try your damnedest to measure the amenities, right? Mm-hmm. And then like do some regression analysis and figure out how much can be explained by the amenities. Mm-hmm. And then sort of whatever's left, well, what's it got to be? Mm-hmm. Another sort of indicator is commuting patterns. So like if someone's willing to commute an hour and a half to get to a labor market, they're not doing that for the amenities, right?
Right.
So like the longer people are commuting, the wider the commuter shed, the bigger the difference between the daytime working population and like the nighttime population. Those are all pretty good indicators of agglomeration.
That makes sense. Okay, let's take a break and then let's talk about some policies.
Eurovision is here. This year's contest gets underway this week in Malmö, Sweden. But this year's contest comes with a dose of controversy. I'll give you one guess as to what people are mad about. Yes, correct. It's that.
Organizers of the Eurovision Song Contest say they are assessing whether Israel's entry breaks the rules on political neutrality.
I think it's a shame. I think there is no way that Israel should be able to participate.
Pro-Palestinian protesters are taking to the Swedish streets. More than 1,000 Swedish artists, including Robin, have called for an Israel ban. Some European politicians are joining them. Charlie Harding from Switched On Pop joins us this week on Today Explained to help us figure out if Europe can sing its way out of this situation.
So one question I've been thinking about is, you know, what kind of policy changes would be useful to make to sort of facilitate a world where people have more flexibility, particularly given that, like, there is a lot of uncertainty as to what exactly it is people would want to do. And I mean, I remember we had Elizabeth Pancotti on the show and we were talking about unemployment insurance and how it is administered in this very sort of state-centric way that is not going to work well if people are just sort of moving around more or have more tenuous geographical relationships to their employers. I live in DC. Obviously, the federal government is a huge employer here, and in just like a super direct sense, makes like a policy choice about whether federal employees can do their work remotely or not. But most places are not like that, and policy impacts are going to be more indirect. But like, what is it we would need to do to sort of facilitate flexibility in a useful way?
Well, a starter would be the sort of things that you do to just facilitate state-to-state migration to begin with. And I think Elizabeth Pancotti is exactly right about sort of state-administered unemployment systems. I mean, like, you know, I'm a modestly libertarian guy, so I respect federalism and, you know, I respect the idea that you learn about what works from, like, letting states experiment with things. But the state UI system has just absolutely beclowned itself in this pandemic, and I think it's time to pull the plug on that and just federalize the whole thing. Just what a mess. What an absolute mess. You know, states' inability to get stuff to workers fast enough. They're sort of, you know, the state UI systems where it turns out they're using like, you know, 50-year-old software languages to administer it, so they can't be flexible and change how, you know, UI replacement rates. Like, you know, it's just crazy. It's just awful. So I would start by federalizing UI, but that's more important as a bigger picture thing than likely to be a big impact on remote. But haven't got that off my chest. It's really a hard question, and people would come to me with this before the pandemic. So I would have people who want to talk about remote work, you know, people who are work at, you know, they work for colleges and like a sort of low cost of living, but like struggling place that has like a big college or like local government people. And they're like, what can we do? Like, what do we do to get remote workers here? And, you know, the very direct approach was pioneered by Tulsa, Oklahoma, where they paid people $10,000 to move there.
Huh.
Now, Tulsa, it's worked out really well for them. You know, they've gotten a lot of people to come to Tulsa through this program, but they sort of have like first mover advantage in that, like, if you're the first place to offer $10,000 or maybe the second or maybe the third to remote workers, it kind of works. It's like a branding thing, and you now Tulsa is like this home of remote work, and like So like it was smart for them, definitely. But like if you're the 100th metro, I don't think that $10,000 is really a good idea, and I don't really think it's a good like scalable solution. And so like there really honestly aren't that many policy levers we can push here, and it broadband is an obvious one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, but broadband is like a thing that everyone says, like even before pandemic. It's like, what do we do for rural places? Well, we do broadband. And so like, I would love to see that be taken more seriously. That's an important factor. I think like, if you're kind of a place that's friendly to entrepreneurialism in general, that's important, because like remote workers are going to be also, a lot of them will be entrepreneurs as well. Like freelancers before the pandemic were about as remote as normal people are now. So like it was a very, very remote way of working. And so like that's, how do you appeal to entrepreneurs? How do you like not have like onerous like business registration, business taxation, licensing sort of things? Like that's an important thing to consider. And then like it sort of takes us back to just like basic quality of life stuff. Like just don't be a bad government, and don't like spend all your money trying to lure in like these massive companies and stuff. There is not an easy pro remote work platform, right? Like there's not like, this is the switch. These are the switches to flick to like get people in.
So in some ways I feel like that's the real promise here, right? I mean, it sounds dumb, but it's that like the best way to take advantage of the possibility of more people working remotely is to provide good public services for your tax dollar, or else not collect the taxes if you don't have anything useful to spend the money on.
Pretty wild and novel idea, isn't it?
No, I mean, right. So it's like a bummer because it's like not a really interesting take, like don't waste money on dumb stuff, or, you know, like make the roads nice, or, you know, if you pay people to build a park, have the park be good or in a location people want to go to. But for a society, right, I actually think this has been a huge problem, that we've had a lot of agglomeration in a handful of big metro areas, which consequently has let them get away with like very low quality governance. And then other places have not actually been able to capitalize on high quality governance, right? Like it hasn't mattered if the city council in Bangor, Maine does a good job, really. You know, I mean, it's better to do a good job than a bad job, I guess. But like Bangor was Bangor. They had no real power to change that. Trying to get some deal where you get some company to come to town might have been the best available option. And then other places could just, you know, blow money on whatever, and it didn't matter because people are going to keep coming to the Bay Area for work. And, you know, it was totally irrelevant whether they were well governed or not. And we could potentially get to like a much better place if everyone has to do a good job.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. It's like not as exciting for policy people to talk about, but I think it is true. And you know what? If local government people, state government people, if they need that shiny thing, like that thing to really do and to like advertise, like make it broadband, you know, make it that this is a great place with broadband. And you know, you talked about parks, like put broadband in the parks, put broadband in libraries, like make it so people can remote work all over the place and that there's lots of nice places to work. And that's, I think, about as much as you can do. Beyond that, I think that there's a lot of local institution building, and I'm not sure how the government, you know, best plays a role in that, but I think that like making sure that there's co-working spaces, right? And like, I don't know that the government needs to do anything about that, but like if you're doing something that makes it hard for co-working spaces to arise, then certainly stop doing that. And just like making sure there's lots of nice places to work from. And, you know, how do remote workers work together, and what do they need in terms of, you know, services? And I think that this becomes especially true when you're talking about sort of remote entrepreneurs, because, you know, remote entrepreneurs sort of need more services, they need more help, they need more information on how to do it right than a person who just works for a company as a full-time employee.
Well, how do you mean? I mean, what's a remote entrepreneur in that sense?
So a remote entrepreneur would be someone who like is a graphic designer or a programmer and they work freelance. Mm-hmm. And like, for example, just to throw out a random on Upwork.com. so like those people, they, you know, you have to learn how to be a freelancer. You have to learn how to find clients. You have to learn how to use platforms. And there's a lot of opportunity out there. You know, we see a growing interest in hiring people this way too, and also working this way. So I think that local institutions, colleges, you know, focusing on like, you know, entrepreneurship, you know, remote work entrepreneurship, that the ability to go remote helps in entrepreneurial sense, not just like if you want to be a sole proprietor, like now it's a lot easier because people are used to hiring people remotely, both directly and as independent professionals. It also is a lot easier to do a startup now in these places because like you no longer are going to be sort of like, you know, if you want to start a tech company, you used to have to like, okay, well, I guess I have to go to San Francisco because that's where the tech company workers are. But if you live in Dayton and you want to start a tech company now, like you can hire a workforce remotely. You can sort of scale remotely. And I think that the way that, you know, remote work impacts on entrepreneurship, both at the independent professional level and at the startup level, is something that needs a lot more discussion.
So, you know, one question that raises for me, right, is there's always this kind of lingering question in economics, which is like why are there big companies at all, right, instead of people just sort of contracting with each other? And well, so one reason is that if people need an office to work in, it's like it's obviously better, right, to have a sort of centralized provision of the office and the office space and somebody who's in charge of that and all those kinds of things, versus it's always been the case that freelancers do more remote stuff. But so if everything is more remote, that seems to imply, well, maybe there should be more freelancers, right? Or that work should take place in much smaller units. And do you think that's what we're going to see?
Yeah, I do think we're going to see some of that. And, you know, I know that probably sounds a little self-serving, but to sort of defend
my independence. It's good to be self-serving.
Well, to defend my independence and credibility on this, you know, I was at Upwork before the pandemic started, and I did not say that there was going to be more freelancers over time. I said that online freelancing platforms are going to have a greater share of the freelancer market, but I did not see any overall trend in the percent of the workforce who is freelancing over time. So this is not something I've been just sort of saying since I've been here, but I do think remote work changes it. And I mean, you can see it in our platform data. And like, you know, if you look at our you know, public financial statements where we talk about growth, like you can see it there. It's pretty incredible. And like we are hearing, you don't just see it in the data, but you know, I talk to people in our sales team who go out and talk to large enterprises who are like, you know, big customers for us. And we have like 30% of the Fortune 500 or something like that. And like they go out and they talk to these people and they figure out like what parts of what you do at your company make sense to make, you know, freelance. And what they're finding is like that remote work used to be this huge bar that people had to get over in their head to start freelancing. They're like, you know, they'd like the idea of what we do, but they'd say, we can't work remote. We don't know how to do that. And so now that everyone does work remote, like that bar is no longer there. And so you're seeing a lot more comfort with sort of remote independent professionals. And I do think that what you're saying is going to happen.
Right. And I mean, I always think metaphors are sort of telling, right? And so the question would always be like, well, should we contract this out or should we do it in-house, right? And in-house is very literal in a traditional office environment, right? And one of the advantages to doing something in-house is that they are right there in your office. And if your whole work paradigm is working with people face-to-face, it's very challenging to say, no, I'm going to switch gears now. Right. And this becomes somebody we're working with remotely. So that becomes a good reason to sort of integrate it versus if you are going to be dealing with people on Slack and Zoom or, you know, just on the phone one way or the other, that no longer becomes a sort of rationale to have them inside the inside the firm, right? You could, and you could say, well, it'll be better, right? Instead of having one graphic designer who does all our graphic design stuff, we will contract with a half dozen different people for different kinds of things because it's all remote anyway.
Yeah. And, you know, another advantage there is that if you're going remote from in the office, you have much more ability to sort of like hands-on manage and monitor. And like, you know, if your office is next to the guy's cubicle, you see whether he's working on the thing or not. So I think that there is something to be said for when you go outside of the firm, you're often paying for the product and not the labor. And if it's more difficult to sort of monitor labor when you're remote, then that suggests that you might prefer to pay per product and pay for the deliverable. Versus, and then like be like, I don't need to watch you. I don't care when you're working on this website redesign or this algorithm or whatever. Like, it doesn't matter to me. You just, here's the date it's due by. And so like, you know, it lends itself to this kind of work.
Oh, I see. Right. Because you're saying normally you pay an employee for their time and then you try to get them to do tasks during that time, but you pay a contractor for that. Like when I write a freelance article, I get a fee for the article. They don't care how long I work on it versus when I'm working on staff, I'm just kind of like around, you know, I mean, I do what I do, right? And they assess whatever the value to that is. That's interesting. So do you think though that like that's, is this overall like change for the better or is it going to be kind of like sad seeing cities unravel and people subject to, I don't know, like less connections with each other, things like that. I mean, so much of like this pandemic experience has obviously been stressful on a whole number of levels. But like, I personally, like I do just miss wasting time on face-to-face interactions during the day. Like, are we going to be happy about this?
So I think that there's a couple of things that one is, like you said, you don't want to confuse the pandemic for remote work, mm-hmm. right? And post-pandemic, it's not going to be the case that you have to work at home if you're a remote worker. You have control over your socialization, mm-hmm. right? And if you want more socialization, you can get more socialization. You can go work at a co-working space or you can like create new arrangements. And I really think that like going from like relatively few remote workers to like lots of remote workers is going to open up all sorts of different kinds of remote working options. So like, for example, you know, I worked remote before the pandemic, but I was like my only friend that worked remote. No one else, mm-hmm. No one in my social circle works remote. Now I have two very close friends who are full-time remote workers and they're going to be post-pandemic. And we've already talked about like when the pandemic's over, like we should do some co-working days together. And I've got this, you know, basement office and with room for two extra people. So like I'm going to be socializing with my friends in my office. And it's like, that's not just socializing, but it's like socializing with people you actually prefer to socialize with, not like a random assortment of people who you've been matched to because of your, you know, organizational compatible skills. Like, so I think that there's a lot of potential for stuff like that. And, you know, it's also before the pandemic, you used to hear a lot of stuff about work-life balance for professionals being a problem, right? You used to hear about like, oh, they're making work their lives and like they're not spending time with their family enough and like spending too much time at the office. And now like that has been like entirely forgotten. And everyone's like, well, you won't spend enough time with your coworkers. Isn't that like this huge tragedy? And like, maybe it's too much in the other direction for some people, but like, let us not forget that we had this problem of excessive work and excessive putting work at the center of your life. And like, you know, being home with your family and your kids more often or with your friends, like we used to think that was probably a good thing.
Yeah, I always wonder, I remember I was in college and I read one of the things professor assigned us was a study of a company that adopted like a more flexible work schedule thing. And everybody was like, oh, this is great. And then when they talked to them privately, they were saying that it was terrible and that by making it more flexible, they had way more time for like family obligations, which meant that they now had no like time to themselves, that they actually liked the sort of inefficiency of no, I can't go to that piano recital. But like nobody wanted to say that because it's like too stigmatized. You know, so I mean, I do think we always have these kind of questions of like what people say versus what they actually do. And it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out. But I mean, I do think your point is well taken that like absent a pandemic, you don't need to literally work from your crappily set up living room home office. When I was working remotely for a couple of years, I like had a regular hangout spot and a regular cast of other people who like we were all buddies, and you know, not every day, we weren't obligated to show up to Mocha Hut every day, but like some subset of that group of people would be there on any given day. And if you like wanted to be around people you knew, you sort of knew you had that option. Could be a boon for coffee shops with comfortable chairs.
Yeah. And it's like, that's under your control. It's your choice. It's not like I was placed in the cubicle next to this person and now I have to be there for the next decade. And like you choose when you want to socialize, if you want to socialize, who you want to socialize with. And so will socialization during the workday go down? I think probably. If you look at there's a nice new BLS study that looks at, you know, people who were remote workers before the pandemic and compares them on their office days to their off office days. So like part-time remote workers, and, you know, they see fewer people and have fewer interactions on their remote days. That's sure. But they spend more time with their families and they have lower commutes. And it's like, I feel like if you were to strip the pandemic context out of this, and also maybe if you had just presented this as like a hypothetical in 2019, and you ask, like, is this going to be better? Is that better for people? Like, everyone would be like, that's great, the work-life balance, spending your time with your families. But it's like, then we have it, and now all of a sudden, like, the pessimism take engine has, like, roared up, and it's like, well, people need to spend more time with their coworkers. That's really important. It's like, where were you, you know, 12 months ago?
Pessimism is the fuel of media engagement for reasons that I don't totally understand, but it's clear in the data. You always got to look on the bad side of things. But thank you so much, Adam. I worry for the podcasting industry that, you know, we need our commutes to keep people consuming the content. But, you know, Weeds ratings have held up well. So thanks to everybody out there for listening. Thanks, Adam, for joining the show. Thanks, as always, to our sponsors, to Eric Janakis, our producer. And the Weeds will be back on Tuesday.
More to-dos, less time, and an infinite number of tools to keep track of. Sometimes doing business has never felt harder, but you don't need a miracle to hit your goals. You can just use HubSpot, because their all-in-one customer platform can make growing your business infinitely easier. Imagine this: high-quality leads, fast-closing deals, wildly happy customers, and more benchmark-breaking quarters. It's not a miracle, it's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.